was a college student in 1968 in Richmond, Virginia. And that was in the fall. And later that fall, I found myself to be a pregnant college co-ed in Richmond. I'd been seeing a boy in Greensboro, North Carolina for a while, so I thought I should go and tell him. So I went to Greensboro, and I didn't know exactly what to expect, but what I found was not so wonderful. I told him, I said, "We're going to have a baby," and he said nothing. It was silence, and he turned and walked the other way. Well, being as young as I was, I went back to Richmond and went back to school, dancing and singing and taking all of my classes and basically acting like an ostrich with my head stuck in the sand. But when you're going to have a baby, it makes itself known pretty quickly. So that didn't last terribly long. I told no one what had happened to me, because I was trying to ignore it, thinking maybe it sort of might go away. And after Christmas, I came into my dorm room with a leotard and tights on, which I wore most of the time. And my college roommate took one look at me. I hadn't told her a thing. She took one look at me, and instead of saying anything to me, she called my daddy. Well, my parents lived about 2.5 hours away in a little town up in the valley called Front Royal, Virginia. And she said, you've got to come down and see Susan, and you have to come tonight. Didn't say anything to him about why. Well, you have to understand that my daddy and I were like two peas in a pod. I was an only child. He was the apple of my eye. I could do no wrong in his eyes. We knocked around together when I was a kid, and the last thing I ever wanted to do was disappoint him and have him think that his good little girl had turned into a bad little girl. So I was really scared. So he came, and we went out to dinner, and we talked a little bit, and I looked down at my napkin, and he said, "Sweetie, what's going on?" And I got up my nerve, but I couldn't look at him yet, and I looked at my napkin, and I said, "Teddy, I'm pregnant." And when I finally got the nerve to look up at him, he had a very soft look on his face, not what I expected. His eyes were a little bit misty, and he looked at me and he said, "It's okay, it's okay. Everything's going to be all right. We'll take care of it. And I just want to tell you, Susan, you look really beautiful." So he went back home and prepared my mother, and they came to get me the next day. But in 1969, if you were a pregnant co-ed, you had to resign from school or you were expelled, unless you were married. It was absolutely unheard of for you to be there and go to school. So I went back to my hometown, and my parents and the boy's mom, flurry of phone calls, a marriage was arranged, but the marriage didn't happen. And my parents arranged for me to go to an unwed mother's home outside of Richmond, Virginia, where I'd been in school. It was a very remote place where I was. Well, we drove up. I had no idea what to expect. We drove up to this driveway, and there was this huge iron gate right at the end of the driveway. They opened the gate. We drove up the driveway, and there was another iron gate in the courtyard in front of the building. Walked up that. The door was locked. Opened that, let me in. My parents went one way to an office. I went another way into a wing where there were other girls who were pregnant. And it dawned on me I had been put in a super max prison for unwed mothers. And I was there the entire time I was pregnant until it came time for me to have my baby. Nobody prepared me for what was going to happen. I didn't understand labor. I didn't understand delivery. But I knew that I was going to labor. So they put me in an ambulance in stealth mode and took me to Richmond to Johnston Willis Hospital. I went into a freight elevator with a sheet over me into a room by myself. They locked the door, said nothing. Eventually, a nurse came in with a tray and shot me up with enough drugs to kill an elephant. I was asleep, was unable to experience the labor of my child, the birth of my child, and when I woke up the next morning, I was no longer pregnant. Nobody came in to say, "Susan, you have a beautiful baby girl," but they brought me a bundle. And when I took one look at this child, it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. It was an unconditional love that I just had never, ever experienced in my life. And I named her Sarah Elizabeth Matthews. We went back to the maternity home. I mothered her for 31 days. I was her mommy. I sang her every Broadway tune I knew. We danced to James Brown, who was my favorite, in the halls. I told her all about her family and about me, hoping somewhere that she would keep this in her head. And at the end of the 31 days that we spent together that were so joyous, I also would sneak out of my room at night, not allowed to go into the nursery, but I would sneak out of there and go sleep underneath her bed just in case she cried. So the end of the time came, 31 days, and a day came that I've come to call the terrible day. It was the worst day of my life. I was put in a car and taken to Richmond with my baby, and we went into the adoption agency building. They walked me into a room with Sarah and said, "You can have a few minutes to say goodbye." Well, you can't say goodbye to your own child. So the only thing I really knew to do at that moment was to sing. So I sang one last song to her, "Someone to Watch Over Me," and all of my tears landed on her cheeks and all of my kisses, that I did everything I could to make her know how much I loved her. I turned around and walked out of the room. I couldn't see, but I signed whatever they asked me to. It took two people to get me out of the chair to walk me out of the building. I was so devastated. And as I looked to my right, I saw a car with a lady carrying my Sarah. And I thought, is that her mommy? Where is she going? But she was gone.
I was born in July of 1969 in Richmond, Virginia. And I always knew I was adopted. I never didn't know. It was always part of my story. My brother was adopted too, and my parents always knew they wouldn't be able to have children. And when I was a little kid, I was never curious about my origins and where I came from, but I was definitely not encouraged to be curious about it.
After the terrible day when I went back to my hometown, I was armed with the knowledge from the unwed mother's home that I was not to ever mention this again. This didn't actually happen to me. I didn't really have a baby. It was a secret that I was supposed to keep, and I was not allowed to ever mention Sarah's name again. Of course, that was impossible for me. So every morning for 44 years after the terrible day, before I even put my feet on the floor in the morning, I would look out to the universe and say, "Sweet baby Sarah, wherever you are, your mommy loves you so much." And I eventually moved back to Richmond. I went back to school. I got my degree, and I was still dancing. And I loved to go to these dance clubs after class to have some fun. And one of the places I used to go was out in the West Hampton part of Richmond to a place called Phil's Continental Lounge.
When I was a little girl, my grandmother, who I was named for, her name was Catherine, she would take me on these lunch dates on Saturday afternoons in the neighborhood where I grew up, in the West Hampton neighborhood of Richmond. And she would take me to this dark place with a lunch counter that I loved because it had York peppermint patties, and it was called Phil's Continental Lounge. As I grew to be a teenager, I became more curious about my adoption and my original family. And when I was, I think, 19, my adoptive mother told me that I had been named by my mother and my name was Sarah Elizabeth Matthews. And I got so excited. It was the first tangible piece of information I had about my identity, never having been related to anyone on the earth before and never knowing where I came from. I got so excited. I called all of my friends together and said, I'm having a party. But really, the party was just to tell them I have a name. And I didn't know what to do with this information. It was 1990, and it was before the internet, and I had nowhere to go with that.
So eventually I got married, and I have three other children whom I'm crazy about. And my younger daughter was a great help to me, and we were moving my mother out of her house into a smaller place to live. And my daughter was putting things in a box to help. And she came out with this stack of postcards, and she said, Mom, you've never been to Europe. What is this? Well, part of the ruse that my parents had come up with to make sure everybody, well, there was tangible evidence that I was somewhere in the world. I took a trip to Europe, but I never went. I was in the home in Richmond, Virginia, but the people who got these postcards, I wrote all these wonderful stories about where I'd been, total lie, every one of them. Were sent to people in Europe, and they went around and posted them with postmarks and stamps from Europe. And my daughter had found this stack of postcards. So I had to say, you have an older sister named Sarah, and she was taken from me. And that was the last conversation we had. She told her brothers and said, look, don't talk to Mom about this because it really upsets her.
So as I got into my 20s and there was the advent of the internet, I hooked up with other adoptees online, some of whom are here tonight. And we taught each other underground, literally illegal methods of searching for family members. Because in most states in the United States, if you're adopted, even if you're an adult, even if you're 44, you're not allowed to have your original birth certificate. Find out any names of anyone related to you by blood. Find out any other identifying information. What I was allowed, since I was adopted in Virginia, was I was allowed to have a narrative given to me by the adoption agency, which was several paragraphs describing physical descriptions of my birth parents and their parents and cousins and grandparents, religious denominations, professions, ages, general non-geographic locations. So I knew my name was Sarah Elizabeth Matthews, and I knew they were somewhere in Virginia, but I didn't know where. And I went to the state and asked them for my non-identifying information because that's all I was allowed to have is non-identifying information, even though I was an adult over the age of 18. And what the state of Virginia gives you is not a narrative. They give you the actual photocopies of your original adoption records with every piece of identifying information cut out with an X-Acto knife. So I have a ream of paper, a folder of paper that looks like Swiss cheese with all of her information cut out. I think I lost my place there. So in 2003, I hired a private investigator who had sterling credentials. She only worked for birth parents and adoptees trying to find each other. And she found some really impossible cases, including friends of mine who were sold illegally and never legally adopted. And I gave her all the information I had. And she came back to me and said, it is really weird. I have never had a case like this. With all the information you have and even a name, I can find nothing. You should prepare yourself that some of this might be fabricated. So I was despondent. That was 2003, and I let it lie. In 2012, my husband and I took a trip to Iceland, and he kept saying, you look like everybody here. And when you're adopted, shit, that stuff happens all the time. You look like everyone here. I wonder if you're Icelandic. And we came home, and I ordered a DNA test kit from 23andMe faster than you could blink because I thought, oh, maybe I am Scandinavian. I want to know. And I got my results back, and I'm not. I'm all British and Irish, but what I found out is, because 23andMe tells you other people that you're genetically related to, other users of their service, I was very distant cousins with a friend of mine, Leslie, who is a fellow adoptee. I'm six cousins with Leslie. What the hell? And I said, I have a biological relative walking the earth, and she's a sixth cousin. I've got people more closely related to me than that. And so in May of this year, I enlisted the help of a woman who runs a database online that I'd been in touch with years ago, and she took all of my info, and within a few hours, she gave me the name of the man who turned out to be my maternal grandfather. And within a few hours after that, I found the name Susan Matthews. And the next day, I found her Facebook page. And even if you're not friends with somebody on Facebook, you can pay $1 to send them a message to something called their other inbox. So I did. I gathered a bunch of childhood photos and adult photos, and I sent her a message in the middle of a work day, and I don't even know what I said, and I hit send.
Let's just get clear about this Facebook thing. I really don't like Facebook, and I had dumped out of it about a month before that because I really only used it to figure out what my children were doing. But I wasn't getting much information, so I plugged it back in very shortly before this day, which was June the 5th of this year. And at my lunch hour, I checked the news, checked my email, checked my Facebook page. I did that. Couldn't find anything about my children, but I saw this blinking light up in the corner. And I opened this message, and I read the first sentence, and it said, "My name was Sarah Elizabeth Matthews. I was born July 24th, 1969, in Richmond, Virginia, and I think you're my mother." And I looked down, and there were pictures of her that looked like me, and pictures of her young that looked like me. Her hair was blonde then. And same blue eyes, same cheekbones. We love her red hair. I looked at the pictures. I ran out of my office. I threw up immediately. I came back to my desk and started typing as furiously as I ever have in my life. I have no more idea what I said typing than flying over the moon. All I could think was yes, yes, yes.
90 minutes after I hit send, I checked Facebook for probably the 100th time, right before I was about to call into a conference call at work. And I opened Facebook, and I saw the response from her. And she ended it with, "Thank you for whatever you've done to find me. I would like to find you right back."
So the rest of the day, we were worthless employees, both of us. We emailed furiously all day long and agreed that evening that we would talk on the phone at 8 o'clock.
And she called me at 7:30.
Because I simply could not wait another minute. Could not wait one more minute.
And we've been inseparable ever since.